Thank you very much, and it's a great pleasure to be here, and I will try to be as provocative as possible. Let me begin with a quote from an article that appeared in the Washington Times just a few days ago, September 13th, byline Ellen Sorokin. Study lists bizarre college courses. Philosophy and Star Trek, Seeing Queerly, and Who is Black are among the college courses offered this year at public and private universities, an annual study of the most outlandish and politically biased courses has found. The study, conducted by the Young Americas Foundation, YAF, also found that radical authors and philosophers, including Cornel West and Karl Marx, have a monopoly in the college classrooms, while conservative scholars such as Milton Friedman and Paul Johnson have been ignored. Now, let me say that I sympathize with these kinds of lists of bizarre courses. I know many bizarre courses in my own university. But I'm a little worried when the first one mentioned is philosophy and Star Trek. Now, this is in part because my book has a chapter on Star Trek in it. But I'd like to suggest there may be an unintended connection between these two opening paragraphs. That the reason why radical authors seem to have a monopoly in the college classroom may be connected to the way conservatives have a kind of knee-jerk contempt for popular culture and its serious academic treatment. And in other words, my real concern is that, generally speaking, conservatives are making a huge strategic mistake pedagogically by scorning popular culture and trying to exclude it from the academy in general. If you look at what young people are interested in today, it is popular culture, and maybe that's a good point for us to begin pedagogically. And so paying more attention to phenomena like Star Trek might actually give conservatives a kind of beachhead. Now again, there are many other reasons why radical philosophers are popular on campus, but their embrace of popular culture, I think, is one of the reasons, and that it's a very big mistake to leave the left a monopoly on the serious study and academic study of popular culture. And indeed, it strikes me more generally as a bit odd that people who, generally speaking, are in favor of the American way of life, and that means capitalism and free markets, turn around and reject the market as a force for producing good culture. There are so many things that we believe the market can do. Again, it strikes me as odd to think that it's a purely negative force when it comes to culture. Indeed, it's generally speaking the left that has contempt for money-making as a motive, and it surfaces in its view of culture. Here's a quotation from a Chicago journal called City Talk from May 21st, 2001. They were doing a little puff piece on a local actress named Janet McTeer, and they say with great pride of her, "The actress has never been keen on doing big Hollywood movies, which," she says, quote, "all seem to be about money-making, and I don't find that terribly interesting. Today in our world, art has to be commercial. That's a really sad point of view. If Shakespeare had to be commercial, he wouldn't have written the things he did." Now, I'm glad to see many of you laughing, and the wonderful film Shakespeare in Love brought this home to us. Shakespeare was a commercial artist. He was the most successful playwright of his day. He was the only one who got a percentage of the gross of all the, he had the best contract of any of the Elizabethan playwrights, and he's prima facie evidence of the ability of a marketplace to produce great art. And indeed, as I've studied this matter, more and more I've come to the conclusion that culture is popular culture, that culture is mass culture, or more to the point, yesterday's popular culture becomes today's high culture. Today we look back at Shakespeare and say that that's the high culture it is, greatest writer ever who ever lived. But he grew out of a world that was essentially mass culture. And the reason this is so is culture is a very unpredictable thing. It's very easy in hindsight to say what the great works of the 16th or 17th century were, But at the time, we're very lucky that nobody was policing the Elizabethan stage, or at least not policing it carefully enough, because it meant that all sorts of things could be tried out. And in a marketplace situation, Shakespeare rose to the top. And there are so many aspects of the Elizabethan theater that are so much like Hollywood. The sequel, for example. Shakespeare invented the sequel. Henry the Fourth Part One, big success. Next thing we get is Henry the Fourth Part Two. And there are many other of the standard sort of Hollywood type methods of producing culture that you can observe there already. Now, there are ways in which elite cultures have succeeded. Aristocratic patronage has done a great deal at various times, church patronage. But it's surprising how many of the most interesting developments in culture have come out of a kind of mass environment. Tyler Cowen's written a wonderful book on this subject called In Praise of Commercial Culture. It's a good corrective to this, again, almost knee-jerk reaction that if something's commercial, it can't be culturally sophisticated. Now, as I said, the Elizabethan theater is a good example of this. In the 19th century, two of the greatest cultural movements were mass culture, Italian opera and the English Victorian novel. What you have here is situations where you've got a vast flood of production and the cream rises to the top. It's been estimated that some 40,000 novels were written and published in England in the 19th century. Of those, there may be 200 that we still read today, and 100 of those are by Anthony Trollope. So it's remarkable how many of those novels died, and when I've checked into one or two of them, it was with good reason that they died. But I'd offer that as one paradigm of how culture operates. Again, you get this mass production, 400,000 novels, and that allows a Dickens or a George Eliot or an Emily Bronte to emerge. Now, what's interesting is if you go back to the way the novel was received, it's a real object lesson in what not to do. I find it, in some ways, very hard to argue for contemporary popular culture because this sorting out process has not yet occurred. In my book, I tried to pick some series like The Simpsons and The X-Files that I think are examples of classics on television that will endure, much the way Shakespeare or these Victorian novels did. But when you look at a popular culture up close and from within it, what you mostly see is the trash. Just as if you'd been reading these novels in the 19th century, 399,800 of them would have looked like trash. So must understand that we're always looking at culture in hindsight. Over the centuries, we filter out the works that are really great, and that gives us an illusion that all the works were great. Greek tragedy, for example, it's estimated that there were about 1,000 tragedies produced in ancient Greece. Of those, 33 have survived. If we had all 1,000 of them, we might have a very different view of Greek tragedy. If we had the plays of Agathon, we might understand why Plato is so negative about Greek tragedy when he writes about it. Anyway, when you go back to the 19th century and a little historical enterprise, you find that, in fact, people were saying the same thing about the novel in the 19th century that they say about television today. There's an excellent book by a man named John Tynan Taylor called Early Opposition to the English Novel, the Popular Reaction from 1760 to 1830. And he documents again and again the negative sentiments people had about the novel. But what struck me most about this debate is it's not just that people complained about individual novels. They complained about the very act of reading itself. And that's where my title comes from. I expected to find that people would look at one novel or another and say, look, this is pornographic, or this is encourages one vice or another. And you certainly see that. But what was really surprising to me is that people talked about reading then the way they talk about viewing television now. That is, and in fact, the standard complaint now is television is awful because it prevents young people from reading. Well, back at about 1810, people were saying reading is awful Then they said, because it prevents young people from working, chiefly working in the fields. But it was the medium itself that people objected to. Now, again, you get some of the sort of standard moral objections. I'm going to be quoting now from a book by Robert Aldrich called The English Common Reader, which is another very good book on the subject. He writes, "It was easy to amass a list of evils that fiction and the drama achieved. Impossible in the strict evangelical view to think of any benefits. Ask the man," urged a writer in the Methodist magazine, and this is from 1819, "ask the man who with a smiling but vacant countenance rises from reading Tom Jones, Don Quixote, etc., if his judgment is better informed, if his mind is more expanded, his stock of ideas increased, or if he is better prepared for performing the duties of his station. The answer was obvious. Reading fiction was, quote, a waste of time." The same writer argued that God specifically forbade the reading of novels, and he offered citations from scriptures to prove it. Now, you know, our dream now is to get a kid to read Tom Jones or Don Quixote. And, you know, I do it. I teach those books. But here back in 1819, some were saying, do you get any benefit? Are you in any way a better person for reading these novels? Now, you may say that this critic may not have been very acute. But here's Samuel Taylor Coleridge, one of the great English Romantic writers. And again, I'll read you what Aldrich says about it. "More people were reading than ever before. But in the opinion of most commentators, they were reading the wrong things for the wrong reasons and in the wrong way. What depressed these observers more than anything else was the apparent decline of serious purpose in reading. Sharing the familiar human bent for idealizing the past, they maintained that things were far different and infinitely better in the old days before reading had become democratized." And again, this is much the way popular culture is criticized today. "The identical lament is heard today," Aldrich says, "but perhaps some comfort can be found in remembering that Coleridge had felt the same way in 1817, when interest in reading was only beginning to appear among the masses. 9/10 of the reading public," he wrote, "confine their attention to periodicals, a shelf or two of beauties, elegant extracts, and circulating library novels. The readers of the latter were, quote, that comprehensive class characterized by the power of reconciling the two contrary yet coexisting propensities of human nature, namely indulgence of sloth and hatred of vacancy. Their favorite kill time, Coleridge refused to dignify with the name of reading. Call it rather a sort of beggarly daydreaming, during which the mind of the dreamer furnishes for itself nothing but laziness and a little mawkish sensibility. Such activity," he said, "was on the same plane as gaming, swinging or swaying on a chair or gate, spitting over a bridge, smoking and snuff-taking." Now again, this is about reading he's talking about, the thing that we prize so much. And now, what was going on in the 19th century was indeed an enormous democratization of reading, largely brought about by the power of the emerging free market in 19th century Britain. Among its great technological achievements is it produced steam presses that could print books at a much higher rate, and it produced cheap paper. And as a result, books became available to people in 19th century Britain in a way that had never been possible before. Now, it's two interesting market aspects of it. Most people don't realize that books were marketed the way videos are now. There were sort of blockbuster bookstores all around. Books were largely rented in the 19th century. They were still rather expensive to purchase, so people would go to what was called a circulating library and they'd rent a book for a certain time period. And this led to much more diffusion of books. And they were also serialized. They would appear in magazines in clusters of 2-3 chapters at a time. That's the way most of Dickens' books were published. But that very mode of publication, again, upset people at the time. And this is what really fascinated me, that it wasn't just the content of the books, but the very medium in which they were presented. Here I'm going to read you from Thomas Arnold, Matthew Arnold's father, the famous master of Rugby School. And this is from a sermon he preached in Rugby Chapel in November 1839. just when Dickens was making it big, 1836, 1837, his Pickwick Papers, the first big blockbuster serialized novel, and just around the time Nicholas Nickleby came out. And this is Arnold lamenting about the state of mind of his students at the Rugby School. And he finds a cause for everything wrong with him. This cause consists in the number and character and cheapness and peculiar mode of publication of the works of amusement of the present day. In all these respects, the change is great and extremely recent. The works of amusement published only a very few years since were comparatively few in number. They were less exciting and therefore less attractive. They were more expensive and therefore less accessible. And not being published periodically did not occupy the mind for so long a time, nor keep alive so constant an expectation, nor by thus dwelling upon the mind and distilling themselves into it, as it were drop by drop, did they possess it so largely, coloring even in many instances its very language and affording frequent matter for conversation. They are that class which cannot be actually prohibited, nor can it be pretended that there is a sin in reading them. They are not the more wicked for being published so cheap and at regular intervals, but yet these two circumstances make them so peculiarly injurious. This is the exact kind of argument you get against people watching television today, that it dulls their minds, too exciting, it takes them away from other things. And he's talking about reading here, and the way these books come out in two or three chapters every week or every month, and that sucks these poor students in, and they're off reading Dickens when they should be studying something serious. Now, I offer this as a kind of cautionary. It may well be true that people are right, that television is simply evil, and there's nothing good on it, but I find it sobering to realize that people were saying the same thing about the novel barely 200 years ago. And no doubt people like Arnold had some basis for what they said. The point is, out of those 40,000 novels published in the 19th century, many were in fact junk and not worth reading. Now, after those 200 years, we've had a chance to sort things out and decide Dickens is worth reading, George Eliot is, and so on. But what I'm saying is that we need to be doing something similar in our own day. It's very much harder to do it while a culture is alive and kicking. But just to turn our back entirely on the popular culture of our day, historically, we should realize that's a mistake. That the people who've done that in the past have missed a great deal of value in their own time. What particularly has struck me in studying these matters historically is how much any new medium confuses people. Time and again, when a new medium comes along, the immediate reaction by cultural elites is to reject it. This was true of the theater in Shakespeare's days, so many people wanted to shut it down. It was true of the novel in the 19th century. It was true of motion pictures earlier in the 20th century, whereas now we accept there are all sorts of classics of motion picture making. The contemporary situation would be television. And again, you get attacks on individual shows, but above all, you get attack on the medium itself. Whenever a new medium comes along, people note what's wrong with it precisely because they're noting what's different about it. They seem to have a hard time understanding what's positive about a new medium, that it can do things that the old media were not able to do. Again, I recognize that there's a lot wrong with contemporary culture, and I'm certainly not calling for us to abandon Shakespeare or any other earlier forms of great writing, but I think we should be awake to the fact that a true culture is always a vital culture, and its popularity is part of its vitality. What's great about someone like Shakespeare, what's great about someone like Dickens, is they were in touch with a popular audience, and it energized them. It's one of the things that made them great, and we shouldn't scorn, therefore, the power of commercial culture. I'll close with a quote from another 19th century writer, Charles Knight, who was defending the English people and their taste for novels. "The English are, so far as I know, the hardest work people on whom the sun shines." and also, as we know, never sets. Be content if in their wretched intervals of pleasure they read for amusement and do no worse. They are born at the oar, and they live and die at it. Good God, what would we have of them? And I think that we should bear that quote by any time we're tempted to scorn popular culture. Thank you.